Patient number one is still doing well after 3 years with the program. She was 67 with a demanding job when her memory issues surfaced. She couldn't finish work reports properly and would even forget her longtime pet's names. Within months of beginning the program, she was doing well at work. She went off the program 4 times, and each time she got worse. When she went back on, she went back to normal. Well, that program is designed to reverse the symptoms of Alzheimer's. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. My guest is the designer of that program to reverse Alzheimer's. He's Dale Bredesen, MD, professor of neurology at UCLA, and the founder and president of the Buck Institute for Research on Aging, and the author of The End of Alzheimer's, the first program to prevent and reverse cognitive decline, published this month by Penguin. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks very much, Norman.
I think we need to start with an update, assuming one is necessary, as to how we define Alzheimer's.
Absolutely. So Alzheimer's is defined actually pathologically, so that in the brain there are so-called plaques and tangles, and the plaques consist largely of something called amyloid, in this case beta amyloid, which is some stuff that looks a little bit like hardened molasses. And then those are scattered throughout the brain, these so-called amyloid plaques, and the tangles are abnormal neuron extensions, an area where your brain cells are reaching out to touch each other, but they are literally pulled back, and they look a little bit like a flame. And these are made largely of something that's called phospho-tau. It's a specific protein. So basically, you are losing connections, and you've got these blobs of what looks like hardened molasses all over the brain. That is Alzheimer's pathologically, and of course, as you know, clinically, what you see is someone typically starts to have difficulty with cognition. The classical case is that someone has difficulty first with memory, but we actually have noted that there are subtypes of Alzheimer's, and one of the subtypes in particular typically starts with things other than memory, things like calculation and dressing and following directions and visual perception and finding words and things like that.
And those aren't directly a function of, say, short-term memory?
Those are not. Those are different. So in other words, these people often will have preserved short-term memory. They'll be able to remember things, but they won't be able, for example, to remember how to calculate a tip, for example. In fact, one of the patients came, that was the very first thing. Very good with memory. She could not calculate a tip, and that was the first thing that occurred.
And how extensive is Alzheimer's? I saw a reference to the fact that, you know, it was identified 100 years ago, but I assume that it existed before that. It just wasn't recognized in any kind of cogent way.
That's correct. So the old Ayurvedic texts from thousands of years ago describe what is essentially dementia. And interestingly, they also noted that there seemed to be these subtypes of dementia. Then, as you alluded to, in 1906, Dr. Aloysius Alzheimer, first looking pathologically and saw the plaques and tangles and described them in a relatively young patient in her 50s. And at the time and for years thereafter, it was thought that this was a, quote, pre-senile dementia. This was something that happened to relatively young people. And it wasn't until the 70s and early 80s that it was recognized that, in fact, this is extremely common in aging individuals. And it was finally realized that this is all part of the same problem.
Do you have a sense that, or hard data for that matter, that Alzheimer's is inevitable if a person lives long enough?
No, that doesn't seem to be the case. And in fact, there are people, the so-called supercentenarians, who live to 110 or more, and they do not show Alzheimer's on autopsy. So in fact, it's not inevitable.
And how broad a problem is it, and is it increasing then? I mean, not out of proportion with the increase in the population.
Absolutely. It is increasing. And in fact, it has now just recently been documented to be the third leading cause of death. So number one is, of course, cardiovascular disease. Number two is cancer. And now number three is Alzheimer's disease. So it is a major problem. It is, as you said, on the increase. And the numbers are really staggering and somewhat scary. If you look at the 325 million currently living Americans and ask the question, how many of us will develop Alzheimer's disease during our lifetimes, the answer is about 45 million of us. So it's about 15% of the population, even though the number that's often quoted is that there are 5.2 million Americans who have Alzheimer's. Of course, most of us are too young to know that we're going to get it. So the number you really want to know is how many of us currently living will get it, and the answer is 45 million. It is headed to bankrupt Medicare in the upcoming years if we don't find a way to prevent it or reverse it. If you look at the genetic predisposition, there is one specific gene that is associated with a higher risk. 75 million Americans carry a single copy of that, which puts them at about a 3 times risk over the rest of the population. And if you look at that same gene, there are 7 million Americans who have 2 copies of it. This is called APOE, the epsilon 4 allele, or for short, APOE4. And 75 million of us carry a single copy, 7 million of us carry 2. If you have a single copy, your chance rises from about 9% in your lifetime to about 30%. And if you have 2 copies, it is well over 50% chance. So it's more likely that you will develop Alzheimer's during your lifetime than that you will not. And that's why we believe it is so important for people to identify where they are and identify whether they are carriers of APOE4 and to get on a prevention program. Essentially, we suggest that everybody over the age of 45 have a cognoscopy. Just as you have a colonoscopy when you get to be 50 or more, you want to have a cognoscopy if you're over 45. And then if there is any question, you want to get on the appropriate plan and prevention. The reality is this should be a very rare disease.
And what would that cognoscopy consist of?
It's relatively straightforward. So there is a set of blood tests that we recommend, and I go through all the different blood tests in the book. There's a set of blood tests that will tell you whether you have specific drivers, specific mechanisms. It's no different than what you'd look at with a lipid profile to say, you know, am I at risk of getting cardiovascular disease? Am I going to have a heart attack in the future? This is the same idea. We've discovered that there are many drivers of the underlying process that ends up as Alzheimer's disease. So you really don't want to wait. You want to know whether you have those today. So that's the first thing, a simple blood test. It also tells you something about your genetics. Do you have any of the genes, and especially APOE4, that give you risk for Alzheimer's? Then the second part of it is a simple functional evaluation, and you can do these online now in 20, 30 minutes, very simple, that basically tests your memory and tests some other basic cognitive abilities like speed of processing and tells you, you know, are you doing well? Are things falling off, and do you need to get on a program? And then the third thing, which you really don't need to get unless you are symptomatic, is to get an imaging, is to get typically an MRI with volumetrics. We now have the ability to look at various areas of the brain, for example, the hippocampus that is so critical for learning and memory and is affected very early in Alzheimer's disease. And you'd like to know, where is my hippocampal volume compared to others my age? Am I at the 50th percentile, the 80th percentile, or the 10th percentile? That's a helpful thing to know as well. But again, if you're asymptomatic, you don't even need to do the imaging. You can basically do the blood work and a quick online test for your cognition.
And those are available, the blood work specifically for the predisposition to Alzheimer's is available now?
Absolutely, yes. All these tests are available now, and I go through them at length and explain why each one is helpful in the book.
And when you talk about imaging and the hippocampus, is that because the brain actually tends to shrink with age? This would be a sort of an abnormal shrinkage?
That's exactly right. So, in fact, as we get older, we do have a mild amount. It's about 5% per year for hippocampal volume decrease. And by the way, If you optimize your various biochemical parameters, you don't see that shrinkage. But typically, on average, there is a very mild amount. When you develop Alzheimer's, and especially if you are in a poor prognostic group, if it's a worse form of Alzheimer's, then you do see shrinkage. And we have some of the patients we deal with will have, you know, less than one percentile for their hippocampal volume. And by the way, those very people have shown improvement as well. So it does not mean that it's impossible to get improvement, but it's helpful to know where your hippocampal volume is. And again, especially if you are asymptomatic, but your hippocampal volume is already low, you want to jump on a program to optimize your cognition.
And did you say that you could actually reverse that shrinkage?
Yes. So we have patients who have low hippocampal volumes who go on the program and who follow up, and I described this as well. This has actually been published in peer-reviewed journals that you can see increase in hippocampal volume. So this is a relatively plastic area of the brain. You know, you are making synapses and losing synapses all the time. You're actively forgetting things like the seventh song that played on the radio on the way to work yesterday, and you're actively remembering, you know, where your keys are and all that sort of thing.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about memory then. You have indicated that there is and ought to be kind of a memory editor that crosses out certain things that you don't want junking up your memory, as you mentioned. So, you know, maybe the phone number of the pizza parlor, but it sounds almost as if what's happening, at least in part, with Alzheimer's is that edit function gets a little carried away and starts erasing things that you don't want to lose?
Exactly. So here's the way it is. If you think about what happens in osteoporosis, which is, as you know, a very common problem as we age as well, you have a set of signals and a set of biochemical messages that essentially drive what are called osteoblasts. These are the ones that make the bone. And then you have a separate set that drive the osteoclasts, and these are the ones that pick up the bone. So you are constantly remodeling your bone. Now, as you get older, your osteoblastic activity can decrease, especially as there are hormonal changes and nutritional changes, and your osteoclastic activity can actually increase. So if you can imagine working on your home, and imagine that you've got a set of contractors that does the demolition and another one that does the construction, and imagine that for 20 years, the ones that do the demolition always did something extra for you, and the ones that do the construction never showed up for work. Your house would begin to get smaller, and that's exactly what happens to your bones. Your osteoblastic activity is outstripped by your osteoclastic activity. And what we discovered in 28 years of test tube research in the lab is that there is an analogous set of signals. There are more. There are many of them in the brain, but there's an analogous set of signals that causes synaptoblastic activity, producing and keeping synapses. These are helpful for memory. And on the other hand, synaptoclastic signals. And the surprise was that when you have Alzheimer's, everyone with Alzheimer's is too heavy on the synaptoclastic side and too light on the synaptoblastic side. So when we prevent or reverse cognitive decline, we do everything possible to enhance the synaptoblastic side and decrease the synaptoclastic signaling.
We keep, it seems to me, discovering this basic human or biological duality, you know, good cholesterol, bad cholesterol, and now we have, you know, two different kinds of memory maintenance, and it seems to be quite the path that we've gone down in terms of discovering these things.
That's exactly right. When I was in medical school, you know, when I first read about the whole idea of yin and yang, I thought, well, this is such a simplistic old idea, you know, and it turns out actually it's quite striking. And as you said, we run into it again and again and again in basic physiology. And it is absolutely crucial for what happens in Alzheimer's disease.
Up to the development of your protocol, what was the track record for arresting or reversing Alzheimer's?
Right. So Weep actually published the first examples in history of the reversal of cognitive decline in Alzheimer's and pre-Alzheimer's, and that was initially in 2014 and then a follow-up in 2016, and we now have several hundred people on this protocol with continued good results. Prior to that, there had been nothing that does this. And in fact, if you look at the decade between 2002 and 2012, there were 244 clinical trials in Alzheimer's disease. 243 failed outright. And the one that, quote, succeeded, end quote, was for a drug called memantine, which has a minimal effect. And in fact, the families couldn't tell who was on the placebo and who was on the drug. So it does have a very modest effect. So the current drugs that are prescribed have very modest effects and, in fact, don't delay or prevent the decline. So the gold standard in the past has been, could we take the decline and make it a little slower? There wasn't any hope for improvement. It was just make the decline slower. And as one very unhappy husband of one of the patients said, why would anyone do that? He said, having lived with this, having lived with my wife as she declines, this is not something that I want to see because things are so difficult already. So it's a really sad state of affairs. And, of course, what we'd all like to see is improvements. And so it's been very, very exciting and heartwarming to see many of the stories.
And how long can a person live with Alzheimer's?
Well, again, it depends completely on whether there is improvement in cognition. Typically, people with Alzheimer's will live for several years, and some of them live 18, 20, 25 years in an advanced state of decline. So it depends a lot on the additional care. In general, people will have things like pneumonia that will end their lives because they're not getting up and about.
Right, and touching back again on the economic impact and certainly the familial impact, this is a disease that in a way is more devastating than most because it can go on so long.
That's exactly right. And in fact, the U.S. spent over $230 billion last year on Alzheimer's and Alzheimer's-related problems. Of course, as you know, it also reduces the workforce because people are staying at home helping their relatives. And in fact, this is specifically a problem. This is, as has been pointed out by Maria Shriver repeatedly, this is a woman-centric disease. About 65% of patients are women, and about 60% of the caregivers are women. So this is a huge problem, as you indicated, both financially and societally. And of course, just with respect to family dynamics, it just, you know, it breaks your heart to see a family after family after family that is devastated by this very common problem.
Before we get into your protocol and these steps that you have developed for, in fact, reversing Alzheimer in your subjects, why do you think, or why have you discovered, is it so female-centric? Why is 65% a number that would apply to women sufferers?
Yeah, we do not know yet why this is, but here's the speculation that makes some sense biochemically. If you look at the contributors to this disease, and we initially discovered 36 different contributors. We now know that there are several more, but it's going to be something like 50, certainly not more than 100 or 1,000, anything like that. There is a set number of contributors. One of the important contributors is a rapid reduction in support for neuronal survival. And so if you cut off, for example, estradiol very rapidly, as occurs during menopause, this heightens the likelihood of developing this state that we call Alzheimer's, which is essentially a downsizing. And so what happens when you go through andropause as a man, you have a slower decrement in your testosterone support, in your support of your neuronal circuits, whereas with women, you have a more rapid decline. That may have something to do with it, and that's supported by some data from the Mayo Clinic in which they looked specifically at women who had early oophorectomies, so early hysterectomies with loss of ovaries, who did not have hormonal support. If they had it at the age of 40 or younger, they doubled their rate of getting Alzheimer's later in life. So it provides some data to support that notion.
Well, having looked at the problem, let's pause now and then take a look at these steps toward not only arresting, but in some cases reversing Alzheimer's. Back in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Del Bredesen. He's a neurologist who has, over the course of a long time, developed a protocol for arresting and, in fact, in some cases, reversing the effects of Alzheimer's, and definitely cutting-edge science, and not without its controversy, too, I suspect. But before we get into those steps that you have determined for the reversal of Alzheimer's, just to give us sort of the basis, Dale, for what your departure point is for developing these, your premise.
Right. Yes. So for the last 28 years, I've run a basic research lab that has asked one question, which is, what is the molecular basis for neurodegeneration? Why is it that you lose synapses in various degenerative diseases? Why is it that you lose neurons? You know, whether you're talking about Lou Gehrig's disease, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, what is driving these neurodegenerative diseases? And you can argue that these are the area where biomedical science has been the least effective. We have certainly things that help many cancer patients. We have things that help a cardiovascular disease. Why have we been so unsuccessful with things like Lou Gehrig's and Alzheimer's? And what we discovered over many years of research is that Alzheimer's disease is very different than we originally were told. And in fact, if you look at what is driving this problem, what you find is that the thing that we call Alzheimer's disease based on the pathology is surprisingly a protective response, just the opposite of what we've been told. It is a protective response to three fundamentally different insults to your system and ultimately to your brain. So it is both a brain disease and a systemic disease. So the first insult is anything that causes ongoing chronic inflammation. And this can be because you have specific pathogens, so you could be exposed to Lyme disease, or you could be exposed to specific bacteria from your mouth, for example. Herpes simplex virus, this has been found repeatedly in the brains of patients with Alzheimer's disease. Specific molds have been found in the brains of patients with Alzheimer's disease. Or you can actually have chronic inflammation not from these specific pathogens that can actually get into your brain, but you can also have it from things like eating trans fats, eating too much sugar.
Wow.
The sugar molecules actually adhere. They latch on to the proteins, just like remoras on a shark. Your immune system recognizes this as being different than normal and actually can produce an immune response so that you have, again, chronic ongoing inflammation. And of course, what we've all heard a lot about in the last few years is leaky gut. Many of us have changed our microbiomes and actually do leak various contents from our food and from bacteria in our guts into our bloodstream. And so what do? We try to mop these up. We have an immunological response. We develop this chronic inflammation. Chronic inflammation causes your body to react in a way that is protective, that involves producing the very amyloid that we relate to, that we look at and say, oh, you have Alzheimer's disease. Well, what you're really doing is protecting yourself. And why? Because as actually has come out of Harvard, Rudy Tanzi and Robert Moore and their groups have shown that amyloid is a very good endogenous antimicrobial agent. So you are protecting yourself against these microbes or against inflammation. The second reason is what I mentioned earlier. If you suddenly withdraw trophic support, then, in fact, your brain has a downsizing program. And by the way, this is no different than if you are looking at your company and you're saying, you know what, we have something coming in next year but more going out. What's the first thing your company does? It says, okay, we better not hire anybody new. That's exactly what your brain does. It keeps the memories, for some time at least, keeps all the important things that you have gone through. And, you know, when you're learning new things, you only remember the most important ones. So someone asked me one time, you know, why is memory loss the first thing for so many people? You know, isn't that the last thing you'd want? Well, actually, if I asked you, Norman, okay, when you wake up tomorrow morning, either you will have forgotten how to drive or how to think or reason or speak or calculate or do your job, or you will have forgotten the Friends rerun from tonight. Which would you choose? Exactly.
Literally a no-brainer.
A no-brainer. That's exactly right. And that's exactly what your brain does. So the first thing that goes, this is the canary in the mine. You are losing the ability to add new things. And a number of people that we see come in, they can do everything else. They can play tennis, they can drive, they can do their job, all that thing, but they cannot learn anything new. That is telling you, you are starting to downsize, and now's the time to jump on it and improve things. And you want to know, most importantly, what's driving it. So that's what we call type 2. The inflammatory one is type 1. The atrophic one is type 2. And by the way, there's a type 1.5, which has some inflammation and also some trophic withdrawal or atrophic side. And that is what we call glycotoxic. Those are the people that have this combination of too much sugar, so they've got the inflammation from that, but they've also created insulin resistance. And that's very, as you know, very, very common in our society.
Yes.
And this insulin resistance makes it so that our neurons are not supported to the same extent by the insulin that we produce. So they, again, undergo this downsizing. For the type 2 with the atrophic, it can be estradiol, progesterone, pregnenolone, thyroid, testosterone, vitamin D, all these sorts of things, and many, many more that are all critical components. There are what's called trophic factors, nerve growth factor, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. These things all are available and all are helping support this incredible neuronal network that you have in your brain. You have 100 billion neurons, and on average, they have nearly 10,000 connections. So you have this amazing computer inside your skull that has almost 1 quadrillion connections. You've got to support that. And when you start to decrease these various supportive factors, you cannot support that entire structure. So you downsize it, not surprisingly. And in fact, the hippocampus is a relatively plastic one and one of the early ones to go. Then type 3 is absolutely fascinating because it is a completely different looking disease. You still get plaques, you still get tangles, so in fact, you still meet the criteria for Alzheimer's. In fact, many of these people are misdiagnosed early, and then finally someone does a spinal tap or a PET scan and says, oh, this is Alzheimer's disease. These people present, as I mentioned earlier, typically with non-amnestic symptoms. So the first thing that goes is the ability to pay bills or follow instructions or visual perception, looking at things and recognizing what they are, or speaking. They often have what's called aphasia, so they have difficulty with their words. And what's important about these people is that we call these type 3, 100% of these people have been exposed to various toxins. And so, in fact, I was talking to one of the people who called about a year and a half ago, a very successful man, early 50s. And by the way, type 3 is a young disease. Most people who get it are in their early to mid-50s, some people in their 40s, and we have seen people as late as their 60s start this as well. But it tends to be a disease that is an earlier form of Alzheimer's disease that typically does not have as much memory loss and much more of these other what are called cortical symptoms. And when I told this person, well, you have type 3, so that means you've been exposed to some toxin or toxins, and we just need to find out what these are, he said to me, no, I'm not exposed to anything. I live a very healthy life. Everything's good. So this guy turned out to have the highest mercury level that had been seen in the lab in years. So in fact, in this case, if you go to the 95th percentile for mercury in the United States, he was 7 times that. So he was literally off the charts.
Should I ask where he got it?
Yes, and in fact, so what you can then look and see is this inorganic mercury or organic mercury. He had very high both. You get the organic mercury mostly from seafood. And what had happened is that this guy had become a very successful businessman, and he decided that one of the things he would do to pamper himself is to have tuna sushi almost every day. So he was eating way too much tuna sushi. And the second thing was he had specific amalgams. So these are dental amalgams, things in your mouth that actually have inorganic mercury. And then the third thing, unfortunately, he had a very poor ability to excrete the mercury. So he kind of had the perfect storm. He had everything going wrong, which was why his was so very, very high. Now, again, it's controversial about whether mercury causes Alzheimer's. The majority of the people, it's not an important contributor, but in an important minority, it is a very important contributor. Therefore, the point here is not so much what you do, but in fact what you look for. So it is critical when you realize what this disease actually is, what it is actually trying to protect you from, then you need to go out and get the appropriate tests to tell you, here are all the contributors. And by the way, we never, so far, at least in the first several hundred, have found any person with fewer than 10 different contributors to their cognitive decline. So think about it for a moment. Imagine that you had, imagine that you had a place that you set up to fix cars. And imagine that the first 100 cars that came, every one of them had one single thing wrong. They were either out of gas, out of oil, flat tire, what it was. And so now you developed a system where you would fix one thing each time, and that would be great. That's what we did 100 years ago. That's 20th century medicine. We would ask the question, what? Is it heart failure? Is it Alzheimer's? What is it? 21st century medicine is completely different. We ask why. Why did you get this problem? And here's the issue, and here's why there has been such failure in the medical system for these complex chronic illnesses like Alzheimer's. Imagine that the next 100 cars that came in, none of them had one problem. Each one had many things. So, in fact, the gas wasn't completely out, but it was the wrong octane. It was a little low. The oil was low. The bolts were not doing very well. The tires were low. Everything was down. And so you'd look at it and say, well, okay, maybe I'll try filling up the gas on this one. Well, that doesn't really help very much. Okay, maybe I'll try filling up the oil. That's what we've done with these tests for Alzheimer's. There are many things that are contributing to it. We've looked at very tiny data sets. We look at, what's your sodium? What's your potassium? That doesn't work. So now what we do currently is we look at all of the different potential contributors because we know that something is driving. You are protecting yourself from something. And interestingly, the amyloid that you actually make in Alzheimer's, what does it do? It kills the microbes. That's part of the type 1. It helps in the downsizing. That's the type 2. And it actually binds to things like mercury. It binds to various toxins, of which there are many, and it actually prevents them from being as toxic to your brain. So you know when someone has cognitive decline, they are protecting themselves from something, typically many things, and you need to do a large enough look to evaluate all of the different things that may be contributing to this downsizing. So then the treatment, not surprisingly, is to address all of the things that are either putting you at risk or actually inducing symptomatic cognitive decline.
And let's look at that treatment or series of treatments that might be called, I suppose, ways of arresting and, in some cases, reversing Alzheimer's when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. Thank you. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Dale Bredesen. He's a neurologist who has developed a series of approaches to arresting and, in some cases, reversing the effects of Alzheimer's disease. And we've gone through some of these causes and the phenomenon that Alzheimer's is actually a protective approach that the body has developed, which, of course, has a downside when it turns into an actual illness, such as Alzheimer's. But having described somewhat what Alzheimer's is, what its effects are, now we have to get to the nitty-gritty and look into your research, Dale, and determine how you approach reversing or at least arresting Alzheimer's. And it sounds like you have at least three dozen different things that you look at in order to do that.
Exactly. And, you know, this is analogous to what is now being done in cancer research. So, as you know, if you go into a cancer center today, what's called a precision medicine approach will be taken, where you will look at the entire genome of the tumor itself and the entire genome of the host, and then determine from that what is different and what is actually driving the disease, and then, of course, use the specific drugs that will target those changes. Well, in Alzheimer's, we do very much the same thing, with the one difference being that we don't have a tumor to biopsy. So right now, we look at 150 different parameters. We want to know, is there inflammation there? If so, what's driving that? We want to know, what's so-called glycotoxicity? Do you have a high fasting insulin? Do you have insulin resistance? Do you have advanced glycation end products? These are things that are caused. These are the remoras on the shark that I mentioned earlier. Do you have a decrease in various supportive things in your body? Is your nerve growth factor decreased? Is your testosterone, estradiol, pregnenolone, free T3, free T4, you know, on and on and on? There are critical molecules. This does not happen for no reason. So we want to address all of these and then look to see what is optimal. I usually tell the patients that now we're going to treat you like a competitive athlete. It's no longer good enough to be at the low end of normal. We want you to be in the optimal range because that's how we're going to make this system work better. So we look at those. We look at the inflammatory status. We look at the insulin-related status. We look at the trophic status. And then, of course, we look at the toxic status. And one of the big surprises, actually, is this type, what we call type 3 Alzheimer's disease. We published that last year. The surprise was that this is due to specific toxins. And one of the more common ones is a set of toxins called mycotoxins that actually come, surprisingly, from molds and people who are exposed to these. And again, no surprise. People initially thought, this is crazy. How can you actually be getting Alzheimer's disease from mold? We all get exposed to molds. Well, it's not quite that simple. There are specific toxins that are produced by specific groups of molds. So, for example, if you're exposed to Stachybotrys or Penicillium or Aspergillus or Ketomium, these molds can make specific neurotoxins. And your body responds to these, and again, it makes amyloid. So you develop, again, what's called Alzheimer's, but you're really responding to this particular exposure. So once we then have this set, okay, we can say for each person, we make the analogy that there are 36 holes in your roof, and if you just patch one hole, that's not going to help you very much. So we want to know how big is each hole for each person, and we've developed a computer-based algorithm that we use, and it will tell us what percentage for each person, what percentage of each subtype. So we might have someone who has, 70% type 1, 10% type 1.5, 15% type 2, and maybe 5% type 3, that sort of thing. So that's one way to go. And then once we understand what are the different contributors, then we can address each one of these. So if you have ongoing inflammation, why is it? and let's get rid of it. So you can't just get rid of the inflammation itself. You also need to get rid of the cause of the inflammation. If there are ongoing exposures, you need to get rid of those. If you are eating the wrong things, if you're walking around, as for example, one of the patients was walking around with a fasting insulin of 32, it should be 4.5 or lower. Fasting insulin of 32 is giving this person insulin resistance. And in fact, when we looked, and he had many other things as well, we addressed all of these things. He did exceedingly well, and he's now about 3 years into this, has come back, is back to work full-time, doing very, very well. Addressing just one of these is not terribly helpful. Addressing all of them, much, much more helpful. So in his case, for example, he needed to improve his insulin sensitivity, which he did over time. And by the way, people typically take 3 to 6 months to get better, so it doesn't happen overnight. You need to stick with this. As the metabolism goes, so goes the cognition. If you're still insulin resistant, you're probably not going to get much better. This particular person also had specific hormones that were quite low, also had specific nutrients that were quite low. So all of these things were addressed. And they, in fact, ultimately made him much, much better. And I describe this in detail in the book.
Well, let me in the time remaining, scamper through some of the components of, are we calling it the Bredesen protocol?
You can call it that. Some people call it that. We call it RECODE for reversing cognitive decline. And the software related is RECODE software. And we've now used this throughout the world. We've trained now 450 practitioners from 7 different countries and all over the United States. Who are now using this same protocol for people at risk for cognitive decline or who have cognitive decline. And I should say, when you develop this, it doesn't happen overnight. When you get your symptoms, typically this has been going on for years and years, and the usual number quoted is about 20 years. You go through an asymptomatic period, then you go through what's called SCI, subjective cognitive impairment, which lasts about 10 years, where you know there's something wrong, but the tests don't show it yet, the cognitive tests. And then you go through MCI, mild cognitive impairment, where you're now scoring abnormally on the tests, but you can still take care of yourself. And then, of course, the final phase is Alzheimer's disease, where you are losing your activities of daily living. For people who are in the SCI phase, 100% of those people get better. For people who are in the MCI phase, most of those people will show some improvement. And for people, especially early in Alzheimer's, we see frequent improvements. Late in Alzheimer's, rare improvements, but we have seen a few, even later in the course. So when we then address these, as you indicated, we look, for example, if you have ongoing inflammation, we start with something called SPM, which is a specialized pro-resolving mediator, is a specific molecule that actually helps you to resolve inflammation so that you first need to resolve it, then you need to prevent it, and then, of course, you need to remove the cause of it. That's the first thing. We want to look, so we look at your hsCRP, which is a biochemical test to look to see if you have ongoing inflammation. We then want to enhance your insulin sensitivity. So it turns out things like exercise are important. And people will say, well, look, exercise isn't a cure for Alzheimer's. Fair enough. Absolutely true. But to leave it out, to leave out optimized nutrition, we have a specific piece there which is called KetoFlex 12-3. It has specific times that you need to fast, specific things that you do. You need to drive your biochemistry into mild ketosis, because in fact, the ketones that your body produces are actually helpful to brain function, and many groups use that sort of thing. So you want to do a specific amount of exercise. You have to, sleep, another huge issue. Again, people say, well, sleep alone isn't going to cure Alzheimer's. No, not by itself. But leaving it out, we have many people that we see are getting, 5 hours of sleep a night and under great stress and eating the wrong things and living a sedentary lifestyle. And you can see it in their metabolism. So when you look at these tests, you can see what is driving the underlying degenerative process. We look at homocysteine. If your homocysteine is high, that's very easy to fix. You can take an active form of vitamin B6. You can call this is called P5P, pyridoxal 5-phosphate. You also want to take a methyl folate typically, and a methyl B12 and or adenosyl and hydroxo B12. And this again depends on your genetics and on your biochemical profile. So with these larger profiles, we can look at what specifically needs to be dealt with. We want to know your vitamin D level, and if it's less, we typically want to see people in the kind of 50 to 80 range. If you're walking around, as many people are, with a vitamin D of 19 or 21, that is not optimal for your cognitive performance. If you're walking around with a vitamin B12 level of 300, that's considered, quote, normal. But in fact, it's at the low end of normal. It is not optimal for cognitive performance. Then, as I say, specific hormones. If your thyroid level is slightly low, that is not optimal for cognitive performance and is part of what can drive cognitive decline. If your pregnenolone is too low, we want to give you small amounts of pregnenolone, and we want to follow you to make sure that your pregnenolone level is optimal. Very commonly, people have specific metals, mercury, copper, that are actually too high for optimal cognitive function. We measure those. We then want to get rid of that if that is too high. If your zinc is too low, and Professor George Brewer from University of Michigan spent his career looking at people with low zinc and high copper, that is not optimal for cognitive performance and is very frequently seen with people who have cognitive decline associated with Alzheimer's disease. If you are exposed to specific mycotoxins, so we measure those. We can measure various mycotoxins actually in the urine, so you can actually see who's exposed to these things. We can look at where the exposure is coming from, and until that exposure is removed, these people will not improve. So you really have to do a little sleuthing. You've got to be a little bit of a Sherlock Holmes. And by the way, Sherlock Holmes' character was based on a neurologist. So you want to look and see, you know, what are all these things that are actually contributing to the cognitive decline, because in fact, they can be addressed. And this is not to say that the drugs can't be helpful in the right setting, but we would argue that if you're going to take the drug, fine, but do it with the background of the remainder of the program.
Let me just touch on a couple of things with a few minutes remaining here that you are proscribing and prescribing. For example, you suggest eliminating all simple carbohydrates, gluten, and processed food from the diet, at least of this one patient who has had a very successful outcome. And also eliminating consumption of farmed fish. Now, is that because of mercury or something else, the farmed fish?
It's just because the farmed fish, unfortunately, don't have the same high omega-3 to omega-6 ratio. Uh-huh. So the idea for the fish is, and some people like to eat fish and some don't, you can go either way in this KetoFlex 12-3 that we recommend. But yes, if you're going to have wild-caught salmon, and so if you're going to have fish, you don't want to have ones with high mercury. Those are the ones with the big mouths and the long lifespans, tuna, shark, swordfish. You want to stay away from those. And at least if you're going to eat them, check your mercury level. On the other hand, you want to eat the smash fish, S-M-A-S-H. That's salmon, mackerel, anchovies, sardines, and herring. These are the ones lower down in the food chain. They don't have as much mercury, and especially wild-caught, because they're the ones that have lower toxin levels and higher omega-3 to omega-6 ratios. And in fact, as you know, most Americans have poor omega-3 to omega-6 ratios. We have too much of the inflammatory omega-6 fats, and no question, this actually contributes to cognitive decline. So we want to have people with the wild-caught fish that will give you a higher omega-3 to omega-6 ratio.
A couple of other quick ones then. Meditation, you recommend twice a day.
Yeah, you know, and as a neuroscientist, if you had told me 15 years ago I would be telling people to meditate, I would have laughed you out of the room. I thought all these things, nutrition, meditation, sleep, exercise, you know, critical hormones and trophic factors and toxins. I mean, I thought these things were so silly. I really thought that we would find one molecule And in fact, my wife is a family practitioner, and I showed 25 years ago, she told me, you know, when your research is going to end up showing that things that are related to basic everyday things like what we're eating and how we're sleeping, and this is going to be important. And I laughed and said, no. We're going to find one molecule, one region of one molecule that's causing Alzheimer's. Well, I should have listened to my wife 25 years ago, obviously. So the critical thing, in fact, is that there are many things that contribute to the overall coordinated activity. You are changing this fundamental balance, this synaptoblastic to synaptoclastic balance. And guess what? Meditation turns out to be something, and people have actually, you know, looked at meditation, what it does to your telomeres, and shown improvements in your telomere length. So meditation turns out to be very helpful. It does help to lower your cortisol. Cortisol damages your hippocampus. So it is part of the overall state. And we also recommend something called neural agility for people who don't like to do kind of typical meditation. But for those who do, meditation can be very, very, a very helpful part of the overall program. And again, each one of these things is not the total answer, just like, you know, no one instrument is the whole symphony, but it is addressing the overall pathophysiology of cognitive decline in Alzheimer's disease.
You also recommend fasting for a minimum of 12 hours between dinner and breakfast and for a minimum of 3 hours between dinner and bedtime. How does that work?
Yeah. And again, every one of these things has a specific biochemical and or genetic basis. The reason for this is biochemically underpinned. What happens is when you allow at least 12 hours, and by the way, for those who are APOE4 positive, 25% of the population, it actually works out to be better to do 14 to 16 hours for those people because they are better absorbers of fats. There are advantages to being APOE4 positive as well as some disadvantages, both. And so if you do at least 12 hours, or again, 14 to 16 if you're APOE4 positive, what happens is it gives your brain a chance to decrease some of the toxins, some of the, for example, misfolded proteins. You decrease your amyloid, for example, during sleep. You literally, the anatomy of the brain changes very, very slightly during sleep and essentially allows this kind of washing out. You also induce a process called autophagy, which literally means self-eating. What it does is it recycles components of your cells. And by the way, if you block autophagy, what do? You end up getting Parkinson's. So, in fact, you need to clean out these things. They're specific autophagy for batteries, the mitochondria, which are the batteries of your cell, are the critical ones for Parkinson's. So in Alzheimer's, we want to help with this reparative process.
Do you have a plan, or what kind of plan do you have, I might ask, to increase your sample? I mean, we're talking primarily about how many patients that you've studied and had success with.
Right. So we have several hundred now, as I mentioned. And, you know, social networking is the way of the future and certainly the way of the present for many things. But for medicine, for getting this to reduce the global burden of dementia, which is our goal, there are over 30 million people globally who currently have dementia. So we want to take a major bite out of the global burden of dementia. And one of the things that's very helpful is social networking. There's a wonderful website called apoe4.info. Growing rapidly, there are about 1,200 people on now, but more people each day. Most of them are already on some variation of this protocol. These are people who have discovered that they have the most important genetic indicator, APOE4, and are either in the pre-symptomatic phase or the symptomatic phase, and are looking, and they, of course, are interacting with each other, discussing what they've found, discussing the best things coming out of the best labs in the world, and sharing their stories. And to hear their stories, very, very exciting, as a few years ago when I first heard their stories, of course, they were mostly stories of despair. And now the stories we're hearing are more and more positive. And this is what's changing the world. So the goal here is to make this available, which is one of the reasons that we put together the software, so that we can scale this and allow people all over the world to have access to this sort of program. And of course, to make it better, you know, I hope it's very clear, this is only the beginning. I am not saying in any way, shape, or form that this is the optimal way to go at this disease. What I'm saying is that it is a way that has shown some success. And we are continuing to evolve it and tweak it to make it better and better and better. One of the early surprises was all these people who ended up having various toxic exposures. So we're now learning how to deal with them better, how to look for the right toxins, and how to rid these specific bodies of these specific toxins.
Dale Bredesen, thanks for sharing some of your discoveries, some of your research, and some of your hopes for the future. It's been a pleasure.
Great. Thanks very much, Norman.
Dale Bredesen is a neurologist and the author of The End of Alzheimer's, the first program to prevent and reverse cognitive decline, published in August of 2017 by Penguin. I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can join me next time for University of the Air.